You know, it's
brought back a lot of memories being at this Mad Dog Days. I want to thank Paul, first of all, for inviting me down here. Thanks, Paul. It must be at least 30 years ago, I spoke at the Mad Dog Days in Indio. And it was in a Quonset hut in the fairgrounds. Is there anybody in here who was at that Mad Dog Days? Were you there? I want to talk to you after this meeting, because what I remember is that the guy that was supposed to buy the banquet, get the banquet together, stole the money and got drunk. And, you know, that's fairly standard stuff in AA, but we put together some money and got a big picnic going, and it was a hell of a deal. There was only 110 degrees in that Quonset hut, something like that. So we've come a hell of a long ways with the Mad Dog Days. We're not in Indio anymore, for sure. But anyway, that's an outside issue. You might wonder why an old guy like me would drive 200 miles to speak to people he doesn't know about something he doesn't do anymore. And the answer is very simple. I'm guaranteed another day of sobriety by doing this. That's really what it's all about. I first got drunk. The first time I ever got drunk, I was 12 years old, and I was visiting my cousin in town. I lived on a crappy little 40-acre patch of yellow clay hills north of Sioux City, Iowa. It's not the end of the world, but you can see it from there. This farm was really lousy. There was no nutrients in the soil, and we had a terrible struggle to make a living. But anyway, I was visiting my cousin in town around Christmas time, and we had the candy and the peanuts and all the stuff that goes with Christmas. And I found a quart of slow gin in my cousin's house and ate a half a pound of Spanish peanuts and then drank that quart of slow gin and re-stuccoed my cousin's house. 25 years later, I was taking a little nap on my kitchen floor up in Ojai, California. 2:30 in the morning, I just closed the Firebird Tavern, which wasn't a real high-end deal, that place. And I had found a cold chicken leg in my refrigerator and a quart of Mogan David wine. I know some of you upscale drinkers have never had a taste of Mogan David wine, but it's pretty good stuff, actually, if you're really thirsty. And so I drank that quart of Mogan David wine and ate that cold chicken leg, and I was lying on my back on my kitchen floor in front of the open refrigerator door, throwing up straight up in the air and trying to dodge whatever was coming down, you know. Anyway, those are the bookends of my drinking life. I drank after that, but that was the last really bad drunk that I had. Well, I went to school like everybody else. I was the last of five kids born in this family in north of Sioux City, Iowa. I went to school like everybody else and did not do well. If I were in grade school today, they would have diagnosed me as ADD, attention deficit disorder, because I couldn't pay attention. I didn't want to pay attention. I was always looking at the birds outside or the guy that's cutting the grass. And I got crossways a lot with the teachers. And, you know, in those days, they didn't know anything about ADD, and they just referred to us as unruly little bastards. You know, that's exactly how they described us. And so I didn't do well, and I went through just barely getting by all the way through, and I graduated from high school in 1952. That's before a lot of you were even born. 169th out of a class of 175 from the bottom. And I started working in a gas station right after that. I had no plans of any kind for any future education or any future life, for that matter. And in August of that year, I got polio in a bad epidemic we had in Sioux City, 3,000 cases. I was lucky enough to get one of them. And I spent 105 days in the hospital. You know, I didn't have the kind that required you to be in an iron lung, but I can still hear those iron lungs going day and night in the hospital. And I got out of that hospital having lost the use of my legs and a big part of my sense of humor. And I was hanging around my parents' house doing nothing. My buddies would come by and bring a case of beer and we'd get drunk, you know. And that was a pretty good experience, actually, because they came fairly often with a case of beer. And, you know, nothing was happening. And a guy from the Iowa Vocational Rehabilitation Department came to my house one day, uninvited. He just showed up there. I don't know how the hell he got my name even. But he said, we'd like to consider sending you to college. And I laughed at him. I said, Jesus, I just barely made it out of high school. What would I be doing in a college? Besides, sir, I don't think I want your charity. And it didn't hit him just right. He said, well, boy, we're not talking about charity. We're talking about making you into a taxpayer. And I thought that was an odd way to put it, you know. And I said, okay, if you want me to be a taxpayer, I'll go be a taxpayer. So I went down to this little college in eastern Iowa and studied political science for 3 years, enjoyed it. I still have a kind of a hang-up with political science. And after 3 years, the head of the department said, McNally, you have a kind of a weird linear way of thinking. Have you ever thought about being a lawyer? I hadn't up to that point, but I got obsessing about it once he mentioned that. And after 3 years of college, I went over to Omaha, Nebraska to study law with the Jesuit fathers over at Creighton University. And for about 6 weeks, I straightened out my act. I left the bars. I'd been in the bars almost every night in eastern Iowa. I didn't go to the bars. I put on a suit and tie, briefed the cases, recited the cases, acted like I really wanted to be a lawyer. And then the first grades came out. And I didn't do well in the first grades. And it never occurred to me that nobody else did well. They were trying to break down our little egos so that we might be taught something. And but I took it personally. I'm an alcoholic. I took it personally. I said, these people don't recognize talent when they see it. So I went back to the bars and drank my way out of that school in less than a year. I was on the bricks in less than a year. But I bummed around New York City for a summer and went back to school at the University of South Dakota School of Law in the fall. And South Dakota University is not exactly a Big Ten school. It's in a place you've all been, I know for sure, Vermilion, South Dakota. I actually had a guy up in the valley a while back say, yeah, I used to live in Vermilion, South Dakota. And I said, nobody lives in Vermilion, South Dakota. It's a little town of 5,000 or 6,000 people in southeastern South Dakota. And I went to law school there and finished in 1961 and got licensed to practice law in Iowa and started working in a big old real estate firm. Now, they put me to work right away examining abstracts of title to real property. In English, that means they'd hand me a 200-page history of a piece of dirt, which might be a house or a ranch or a farm or a business, and they wanted me to read every word of every page of those 200 pages and then write an opinion about who I thought owned the property, who had legal title to the property. That's a title opinion, they call it back there. They don't do title opinions here, I mean, the same way, but that's another issue. Anyway, I was drinking every night in the bars, and I was sick, sore, and hungover most days. And, you know, next to watching corn grow, examining abstracts of title is the dullest work in the entire world, you know. So I didn't do too well at that. And after 6 months of that job, I got a call from the federal building. My friend Donald O'Brien had been appointed United States District Attorney by John Kennedy when he was elected president. And Don said, how'd you like to be a federal prosecutor? And I said, I'd like to start tomorrow if I could. He said, no, you gotta go through a little investigation. And so I went through the little investigation and got appointed in 1962 by Robert Kennedy as Assistant United States District Attorney for the Northern District of Iowa. Big, long title, little short paycheck. But I had credentials. I had U.S. Justice Department credentials, and I thought I was a big shot. But, you know, the only thing that changed about my life is that I'm now falling off better bar stools uptown. I'm up in the fancy section of town, sitting on one of those upholstered seats, falling off onto one of those upholstered steps instead of the brass rail. You know, when you hit that brass rail with your ribs, it can hurt. And that's the only thing that really changed about my life. We prosecuted a lot of serious federal crimes, organized crime things, and Robert Kennedy had a kind of a thing about organized crime, even though his father was a little cozy with him. And so it was going along pretty well. And until JFK was assassinated in 1963 and Lyndon Johnson became president of the United States automatically. He'd been the vice president. And we didn't care much for Lyndon Johnson. And so I decided to leave the federal government in 1964 and run for the state legislature. If you drink as much as I was drinking in those days, you'd get an idea like that too, maybe. So I got on the ballot in 1964 and got married in June of that year to an unsuspecting girl that had no idea what she was getting into, and started campaigning in the bars as God intended us to do. I shook hands with everybody in that county. It was a county-wide race, and I spent a total of $1,000 on my campaign, which most of which we raised in a hot dog and bean feed. So I wasn't taking money from anybody. Nobody wanted to give me any money. That's the real truth of the matter. And there was no chance of winning because it's a heavily Republican area, and I was a Democrat, and I just had no real expectation of doing very well in that election. Well, it was 1964, and Lyndon Johnson was running for the presidency at the top and running against Barry Goldwater, who was a Republican candidate. And some of you may remember that Lyndon Johnson won that election by a huge landslide, carrying himself and a lot of other incompetents into office, including me. Woke up the day after election and looked at the paper, and sure as hell, I'd been elected to the state Senate. What do you do now? Well, I had a vague idea that you had to report somewhere to serve in the legislature, and that happened to be Des Moines, which is the state capital. And so I got my new bride, who was pregnant with our first child, and we moved to Des Moines. And right away, I found the Savory Hotel Bar downtown in Des Moines. And it was a perfect match. The legislators all went there every night to get drunk, and I fit right in with them. It was a perfect match. Well, my wife wasn't too happy about the fact that I was out every night till very late, but it was important government business we were doing, right? Well, the kind of important government business we were doing, I consider these two legislative achievements as the highlight of our career down there. We legalized liquor by the drink. Now, Iowa had been a dry state up to that point, and the governor, Harold Hughes, was a recovered alcoholic in AA. And so he was the one that promoted liquor by the drink in Iowa. Unbelievable for a recovered alcoholic, people thought. And we got that bill passed. Now you can buy liquor over the bar, by the shot. We also classified beer as a food so you could sell it in the grocery stores. I call that another significant legislative accomplishment. We did some other things that I won't bother you with because they're not relevant to an AA talk. And, you know, while I was there, I was drinking every night, and a guy came to my office one day from Sioux City, pardon me, a guy named Bill S., who was a notorious drunk in Sioux City, and now he's a notorious sober guy in AA. Everybody knew he was a drunk, now they all know he's in AA. So he comes into my office, and he's got these 20 questions from Johns Hopkins Hospital, and he says to me, If you run into anybody down here you think might have a drinking problem, give them one of these 20 questions. It's how we determine if a person's an alcoholic or not. And I looked at the bottom line first. You know, we were drunk, but we weren't stupid. And it says, if you can answer any three of these questions yes, you are definitely an alcoholic. And I wasn't ready to be definitely an alcoholic, so I put those 20 questions in the back of a New Testament Bible where they would avoid any further scrutiny. And got him the hell out of my office. He made me very nervous. By the way, years later, I saw him at an AA convention in Omaha, Nebraska, and I said, Dick, were you 12-stepping me down there in Des Moines when you came down there with the 20 questions? He said, hell no, I had no idea you were an alcoholic. The wicked flee when no one pursues. Anyway, things were not going very well for me, and I was starting to have some serious problems with blood sugar, cholesterol, all of the various things we do when we don't eat anywhere near right. And I was drinking all day every day, and maybe dinner would be a hard-boiled egg and a pepperoni out of one of those dirty bottles on the bar. And that was how I nurtured myself. And so the doctors, local doctors, couldn't figure out what was wrong with me because I didn't tell them the truth. And they sent me up to Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Those doctors up there asked me some dumb questions, like, do you drink a lot? And I gave them a dumber answer. I said, I have an occasional social drink. And they wrote it down. You know, they write down what you tell them. They think that nobody is stupid enough to pay them thousands of dollars to find out what's wrong with them and then lie to them about the symptoms. They can't see any point in doing that at all. We do it all the time. It's none of their damn business how much we drink, right? So They gave me a phony diagnosis. They came back in 3 days, and I said, "What do you think's wrong with me, Doc?" And the doctor said, "We're not sure, but we think you have executive stress syndrome." Executive stress syndrome. It's a fancy name. Doesn't really mean a hell of a lot, but it sounded good to me because there was nothing in there about alcohol or abstaining from alcohol. So I said, "What do you do about executive stress syndrome?" And they said, "Well, you seem quite anxious at times. So we're going to give you some of these blue tablets. They call them 10 milligram Valium tablets." And they said, "You seem anxious. When you feel anxious, take some of these blue tablets." I felt anxious all the time, so I took them all the time. And you know, if you drink a lot of Valium and you drink a lot of booze on top of it, eventually you'll get very serene. And, I got so serene I couldn't hit my ass with either hand some days. I hate to be that vulgar, but that's exactly how it was. And so, you know, things are not going well at all. And I went back to Des Moines, and I didn't run for a second term. I knew they were going to find out about me. I had developed alcoholic paranoia by this time. And I just knew that the public was going to find out about me, and I'd lose if I ran for re-election. There wasn't anything to find out except that I was drunk every night in a Savory Hotel bar. I wasn't selling my vote to anybody. And, you know, as foggy as I was voting what I thought was the right thing to do. Anyway, you know, no matter how bad it gets, by the way, I became a lobbyist after that. I got a job as a lobbyist, which is even a better job for a drunk than being a legislator, because I got paid very well to influence legislation. My job was to make a friend out of every legislator and get them to vote the way I wanted them to vote on certain issues. And I was paid very well to do that, and they gave me an unlimited expense account. I could buy all the booze I wanted for everybody, including me, which I thought was a pretty fair deal. And it wasn't going well, but no matter how bad it can get worse. I was driving my daughter, who is now 3 years old, and my wife and I are traveling on the freeway between Omaha, Nebraska, and Des Moines, when a lady rear-ended us doing about 85 or 90 miles an hour and booted us off a high embankment, rolled us over 7 times end over end, and my wife was thrown out of the vehicle and killed that day on the freeway. And my daughter and I rolled up upside down on fire in this old station wagon we had, and some U.S. mail truck drivers pulled us out of that wreck. My daughter was not physically injured. I had a broken shoulder and some broken ribs, but nothing life-threatening. Well, I was in the hospital 7 days or so, and I got out finally and went back to Des Moines, and I'm sitting on the edge of my bed, and I had one of those keen alcoholic insights. If you ever have one of these, call your sponsor, because you're going to get some really bad advice from your own head. My keen alcoholic insight was, everything that is terrible that has ever happened to you has happened in Iowa. Well, it's certainly true as far as it goes, but it only covers half the facts. Everything good that had ever happened in my life had also happened in Iowa, because that's the only place I'd ever lived. So I persuaded my elderly mother to move to California with us. I didn't know anybody in California. I didn't have a license to practice law in California, but don't let any of that get in your way. If you want to go to California, just go to California. It convinces me that the continent of the United States is tilted slightly to the southwest, because everything eventually that's loose rolls out to California. So we moved up here to Ojai, California, up by Ventura, inland, about 11 miles from Ventura. And I found the Firebird Tavern right away. And lo and behold, they had the same kind of stuff in the Firebird Tavern that they had in the Savory Hotel Bar in Des Moines. So I spent 3 years drinking in the Firebird Tavern. And by some miraculous intervention, I got licensed to practice law in California and started practicing in an old frame house down in Ventura. And I did a lot of criminal defense work, because they don't give the fancy probate cases or real estate cases to the new kid on the block. And I had quite a bit of experience in criminal law before that. And I was having some pretty good luck. And if there's anybody in here that I represented, I'm glad you're out. Eventually, they all get out, you know. Well, it was going along. I was drinking every night in the Sportsman's Lounge in Ventura on California Street. And, You know, if you're a criminal defense lawyer, one of your jobs is to cross-examine police officers. I know there's probably a couple of police officers in here. The job is to make them look like the Keystone Cops, you know, to belittle them and make them look incompetent so that your client will walk out the door. That's the name of the game. But it's not a good idea to do that all day and then meet one of those good people on the freeway at night if you've got a 2.6 blood alcohol, which is where I like to drive, you know, because they will remember you. I guarantee you they will remember you. So I would drink in the fire or in the sportsman's lounge and then sneak through the alleys and go back to my office and crawl under my desk. I had a big old conference table about the size of this table here. And I'd crawl under that table and go to sleep, fully clothed. Pass out is a better word. Fully clothed, you know, suit and tie and the whole thing, and wake up the next morning. And my partner, Eddie, would come in, and he'd look down. "How you doing, Jim?" And "I'm fine, thanks." And you know, it was not going well, I can tell you that. One day I crawled out from under that desk and picked up the Ventura paper, and there's a story in there about the Sarah Retreat House in Malibu, which had burned down partially in a fire in 1970. By now it's 1971. It's in August of 71. And the story says that if you want to make a spiritual retreat, you can come to this, call this certain number and come down to the Sarah Retreat House in Malibu and spend a weekend. Well, I'd made spiritual retreats before, and I knew basically what they did. So I called this number, and the woman said, "Sure, you can make a retreat any weekend you want to come, including this weekend." She paused then and said, The spiritual retreat this weekend is for alcoholics." Now, there's a longer silence on my end of the phone. I said, "I'm not an alcoholic, but I'll come anyway." Keep your options open as long as you possibly can. So I went down there on a Friday night and wound my way up that crooked driveway, and there were 25 or 30 guys hanging around this old mansion. And they didn't look like alcoholics to me, because I knew alcoholics. I represented a lot of alcoholics. These guys didn't have the wiring showing in the face, the bulbous red nose, the shaky hands, the yellow eyes. They didn't look like that at all. They were clear of eye and steady of hand. Couldn't connect it with alcoholic. And so they invited me to stay, and they were friendly enough. And on Saturday night, they said, "Would you like to go to the AA meeting tonight?" And I said, "No, I'm not an alcoholic. I don't know what I would want to go to an AA meeting about." And they said, "Well, you might learn something you can use in your practice." They were slippery as hell. So I went to the meeting. I thought, you know, what have I got to lose? And these guys were sitting around this big table, and they were sharing their experience, strength, and hope. And I'd never heard men talking this way in my whole life. The guys that I talked to in the bars were all talking about our most recent sexual conquests and the wars we'd won and the wars we'd lost and all this kind of bullshit. And these guys were talking about night terrors, talking about waking up at 3 a.m. with a hair standing up in the back of your neck, absolutely terrified and not knowing what it was you were afraid of. I'd had that happen to me a lot of times. They were talking about blackout drinking, you know, losing all recall of what had happened, where you'd been, driving your car, whatever you were doing. I got on a plane one time and flew to Des Moines, Iowa, and met a guy on the plane that I knew. We got drunk, and I blacked out somewhere between LAX and Des Moines. I came to 2 days later driving a rented car west on Interstate 80 and had no recall of any kind of what had happened. And the only clue I got was that I had receipts for two different hotel rooms in my wallet for the same night. Now, I have no idea how that occurred. To this very day, I have no clue about what. I guess I must have had a good time. Anyway, they talked about blackout drinking, and they talked about geographical cures for alcoholism, running from one state to the next or one country to the next to get away from ourselves. And obviously, that had happened to me. So enough more of those statements came forward to convince me that I might just possibly be in the right place. And so when it came my turn, I said the most important words I've ever spoken in my life, and I've spoken millions of words. I said, "My name is Jim. I'm an alcoholic." Now, I didn't believe it, because what the hell? I was a criminal defense lawyer, and I'd said a lot of things I didn't believe. You know, "He's not guilty, Your Honor." You know, This is just a thin tissue of circumstantial evidence pasted together to deprive my client of his liberty. You know, they find him with a smoking gun over the bank teller, you know. Anyway, once I said that I was an alcoholic, a couple of the old-timers cornered me after the meeting. I call them the good cop and the bad cop. The bad cop says to me, I think you're going to drink some more, but we have screwed it up so you won't enjoy it anymore. And the good cop says, don't pay any attention to him. He says, if you think you might have a little drinking problem, when you go back to Ventura, find somebody in AA or look in the phone book for Alcoholics Central Office. And find somebody in AA and go to some meetings and see if there's something that won't help you there. So they were both right. I went back to Ventura and I got drunk and stayed drunk until I was sick enough to want some help. And I counsel people today to say, you know, if you're not done drinking, you know, don't waste our time. Go out there and buy a case of Santa Fe Toque and drink it, you know, that kind of thing. Anyway, I called a guy named Bud G., who was an old-timer in AA. He was 20 years sober, and he worked in the courts as a counselor. And I said to Bud, Bud, I think I might have the beginning of a little drinking problem. And he said, we know. It's hard to be the town drunk and not somebody know about it, you know. So I said, what do you think I should do? And he said, I think you ought to go to an AA meeting today. I said, today? That seems a little soon, Bud. You know, I got a lot of things that I'm doing. He said, you haven't got a lot of things you're doing today. So where shall I go? There's a meeting at 3 o'clock this afternoon at the Norman and Cooper Manor in Oxnard. Now, I'd never heard of the place. It sounded pretty fancy, though. The Manor to the Manor Born. You know, it sounded pretty fancy. So I got in my dinged-up Cadillac, and I had my bullshit three-piece lawyer's suit with the brass buttons, and I drove over to this Norman and Cooper Manor, and it was the worst nightmare a newcomer could possibly have. It's a beat-up old building, it's a run-down building, falling-down building. Inside are these 12 or 13 old apostles in their blue terry cloth robes and their paper shoes. And there's a bare fly-shit light bulb hanging down over the table, and the table's got carving all over it. You know, it's a dump. And these guys look like they're on their very last legs. Well, I thought, Jesus, I don't know about this. I really don't know about this. So I stayed for a little while until the head leper started reading from a blue book. And he said, if you want what we have, Jesus Christ. I said, if I don't get out of here in a minute, I may get what he has. So I left, and I went back to Bud, and I said, Bud, why did you send me to these people? These people are rowing with one oar in the water. And these people are genetic misfits. Why did you send me to this place? He wasn't at all happy with my reaction to the meeting. He said, well, they have meetings for big shots in Beverly Hills. He started to walk away, and I said, wait a minute, Bud, where in Beverly Hills are they? So he came back and said, there's a meeting on Friday night at the Rodeo Drive Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, which was at that time actually on Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills. It's not there anymore. It's in Westwood now. But on Friday night, I drove 75 miles to the Rodeo Drive Group, and my God, that was a lot more like it, I thought. You know, they had these Maseratis and those Lamborghinis sitting out front, and beautiful people inside, actors and actresses, and everybody's all dressed up, and it was fancy deal. I thought, this is about the way it ought to be, you know. And so I stayed for the meeting and started going down there every Friday night. About the fourth night I went down there, there was a gorgeous woman giving a 10-minute talk at the podium, and I decided she had what I wanted and would go to any length to get. So after the meeting, I invited her out to coffee. She had her 10-year-old daughter with her, and it was her natal birthday, and we went out to coffee, and we had a wonderful time. She went, believe it or not, she went to coffee. And we had a wonderful time, and we started dating and talking on the phone, and I was living in Ojai, she was living in Westwood, and 82 days after we met, we got married. You know, that's not highly recommended in AA. It's referred to in the 12 and 12 as boy meets girl on the AA campus. You've probably read that. Well, in our case, it worked out pretty well because last December 3rd, we were married 40 years. And it's Mary right here in the front row. So the interesting thing about that is that marriage is not a cure for alcoholism. I was still drinking. I hadn't stopped drinking. I couldn't stop drinking. And, you know, I'd been to a lot of AA meetings, and I'd heard them talk about losers, you know, the losers that don't make it. And I kept on drinking periodically from September of 71, let's see, September 10, until March 30th of 72, on and off, on and off, and on and off. And by this time, a guy had appointed himself my sponsor. He was a 220-pound Turkish prize fighter who had fought Ezzard Charles 15 rounds in the ring, and Ezzard Charles beat the Jesus out of him, but he stayed in for 15 rounds, which is some kind of an accomplishment, I think. Well, David was crazier than a loon, and he was really on my case. You know, he was one of these Pacific Group types, and he was really on my case. I'd come back after a drunk, you know, and looking like terrible, you know, and he'd say, "How you doing?" And I'd say, I'm fine, thank you very much." And he would say, "Notify your face." And one day I said to him, after about 6 weeks of this madness, I said to him, "You know, I think I know what the problem is, David. I think I'm constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself." He said, "We know you are, just don't drink today." Well, you know, things weren't going very well at all, and I had tried everything I could personally think of to stop drinking. I've been to doctors, psychiatrists, everybody I could think of, and I couldn't quit drinking. And I finally became convinced that I was going to be one of those losers and that I was never going to be sober. So I gave up trying altogether. I gave up trying to be sober or even wanting to be sober, and I said, "I'm going to have some fun. If I'm going to be one of those losers, I'm going to have some fun while I'm here." And I went down to the Firebird, and I drank. And my wife didn't know I was less than a year sober. She thought I had a year coming up. And I told her I don't have anything like a year coming up. So one night I went down there, having given up altogether trying to be sober. Had a bottle of Coors, half of a second bottle. Shoved the second half of that second bottle back on the bar and walked out of the place. Never to have another drink of alcohol to this day. And that was March 30th, 1972, over 40 years ago. Now, if you think you're going to forget what alcohol is like, I can tell you how many beads of sweat there were on that second bottle of Coors. And I'd never, as far as I remember, never left a half a bottle of beer on any bar anywhere, which is insane for me. I'm sober a week, and I said, "My God, I haven't had a drink for a week. What's going on here?" What was even more surprising, and this is the key for me, I didn't even want to drink. That was the key for me, because I always wanted a drink. I always, and everywhere, wherever I was, I wanted to have a drink. So, you know, that was the real miracle for me, and I call it a miracle because that's what it is. I mean, a guy like me that's drunk for 25 years suddenly has his last drink. What's going on? Anyway, I started working the steps with this sponsor, and you know, we were going to hundreds of meetings. We were really very active in AA, and I started speaking in AA at a very early age before I had anything at all to say. That's never stopped me from speaking before, or now even, not having anything to say. And it started slowly getting better, slowly, slowly getting better. I'm sober 2 years, and I got a call from my sister Jean, who is an MD in New Jersey. She was living in New York at the time on the island. She said, "I hear you call yourself an AA." And I said, "I do, because I am an alcoholic." She said, "What is your definition of an alcoholic?" And I said, "An alcoholic is anybody that drinks more than their doctor does." She didn't think it was funny. She didn't think it was a damn bit funny. She said, "That's not funny." And I said, "I think it's very funny." She said, "What did you do about your alcoholism?" And I said, "I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, got the big book, read the big book, took the 12 steps with a sponsor, and I haven't had a drink for 2 years. "God," she said, "really?" "Really," I said. So I sent her a big book, just without any comment, no writing in it. I just mailed her a copy of the big book. She read the book, got sober. She's sober 38 years now. Another ho-hum AA miracle. I have another sister who's now deceased, but she was very much alive then, and I had given her a lot of trouble when I was drinking. She'd come and get me out of a bar, and I'd be raising hell and throwing up in her car, and you know, the usual stuff that we do. So I called her after I was 2.5 years sober and said, "Jeanette, I've joined AA, and part of our program is to make amends to the people we've harmed. I know I've caused you a lot of emotional upset in your life, and I'm calling to make amends." And she said, "It sounds like bullshit to me." She did not accept my amends. And so I went to my sponsor and I said, "This ungrateful bitch will not accept my..." And he said, You've already done your fifth step. Don't worry about it. She doesn't have to accept it. It says exactly in the big book that they may even throw you out of their office." She threw you out of her office is what essentially she did. Well, that relationship healed over time, but it didn't heal for a while, I can tell you that. And that's bound to happen. So things started going on and going on, and I'm going on and going on myself. It looks like, what time do I quit?
5 o'clock. Whenever you feel like it.
All right, 5 o'clock. I know there won't be anybody in this room when I quit. 10 years go by, and I've been trying cases every day in court. I spent a lifetime as a trial lawyer, and I'm looking around the courtroom there one day, and I noticed the only guy that seemed not to be doing anything was the judge. He's sitting up there saying, "Overrule, sustain, motion denied." Not working at all. We're out there killing ourselves trying to prove something or disprove something. So when there occurred a vacancy on the Superior Court up in Ventura County, I made application to be appointed by the governor's office. And I knew it was a dumb thing to do, but, you know, we do the footwork in AA. We do the footwork, and we let the results be what they're going to be. Well, they sent they had a 33-page application, which I filled out in meticulous detail. It's just amazing what they want to know about your life. Then they sent a 4-person, what they call a commission, down to interrogate me about my alleged qualifications for this job. 2 women and 2 men, lawyers, all lawyers. And we had a nice conversation for a couple of hours in my office. And then one of the women lawyers, have to be a woman, said, "Mr. McNally, question 33, you say you're a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous for 10 years. How can we be absolutely sure that you won't show up drunk some Monday morning if you're appointed to the bench?" I thought a long time, and I said, "You know, I'm not going to promise you that I will not be drunk some Monday morning, because when I was promising people that I wouldn't be drunk one Monday morning, I was always showing up drunk. So I won't promise you that I won't show up drunk, but if I continue to do what I've been doing for 10 years as faithfully as I've been doing it, there's a fairly good chance that I will not show up drunk." My next immediate thought was that this rigorous honesty bullshit just cost you that job. Well, it didn't. I was appointed in 1982 and served for 12 and a half years until 1995, at which time I retired. And it was the best and the worst job I've ever had in my life. My anonymity lasted a week and a half. I was assigned to juvenile delinquency court, the first assignment that I had. And there was a kid coming up for a probation review that I knew. I seen him in AA. He's 16 years old, and he was a nice kid. And he had been a little trouble with the law, and had been on probation for over a year, and I couldn't see any reason to keep him on probation. So I took him off probation, and he said, "Can I come up and shake your hand?" He came up to the bench, shook my hand, and said, "Thanks, Judge." Here he turns to a courtroom full of people and says, "Thanks, Judge. I'll see you at the AA meeting tonight." I said, "Thank you." And that's so much for anonymity. And that changed my relationship with a lot of the people in the courthouse. The district attorneys thought that I was going to give away the farm to alcoholics and addicts, and the public defenders thought they had a patsy, and nothing changed, really. I sent a lot of people to AA and NA and CA, and I even sent a woman to Al-Anon one day. She was buying this guy a gallon of wine every day and thought she was doing him a favor. Said, "You got to quit doing that. You got to go to Al-Anon 3 meetings a week." Anyway, I sent a lot of people to AA and NA and CA and GA, and I don't have any regrets about that. I know that there's controversy about that. The damn courts shouldn't be messing with AA. And I used to get delegations of old-timers coming in and saying, "Those damn people you're sending to AA are disrupting our meetings." And I'd say, "Why don't you kick their asses out of the meeting if they're disrupting the meeting?" "Well, the courts are sending them." I said, Courts don't have any authority whatsoever over AA. It's only the poor soul that we're sending there that we have any authority over. Kick them out of the meetings if they're disrupting your meetings. Or you could take a group conscience, and if your meeting doesn't want to sign court cards, you won't be seeing any of my people at your meeting. If you decide, if your meeting decides that you don't want to sign court cards, I can't send them there. They won't get their court card signed. So that seemed to pacify them, you know, and cleared up some serious misunderstandings. But I still get heat from people once in a while when I tell this story about sending them damn people to AA. And so my answer to them is, would you rather that I'd sit and watch them die of alcoholism? That was my choice. So I would do it again if I had the opportunity. So anyway, I'm getting down here to some semblance of an ending. It went along and went along, and my life is getting a lot better because I'm not drinking and I'm not suffering and I'm not sick and sorry and hungover every day. And you can't help but have your life get better, even if you don't want it to. And I was sending people to AA, and some of them didn't appreciate it. You know, I can't imagine why, but they were being ordered to go to AA three or four meetings a week and provide written proof of attendance to the social workers if it was a dependency court case, or the probation officers if it was a criminal case. And I had a guy come in after 6 months. He was on felony probation, and I ordered him to go to four AA meetings a week. He wasn't a danger to society. He was a thief. He was a danger to your property, but not to your person. And he came back after 6 months with 200 and some signatures on his card. The only problem was that they were all in the same handwriting, all in the same pen. And they were supposed to represent 10 or 15 different kinds of meetings. So I said to him, did they ever read what they call the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous at any of those meetings? He said, yes, every one, every meeting. I said, well, if you can recite any one of the 12 steps, I'll take you off probation right now. Long silence. Poor guy. He said, there's something about God in one of those steps. He said, close but no cigar. Anyway, I'm going to wind it up pretty quick. I had a higher power when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that I'd had from my earliest recollection. I had been raised in a major religion, and I had been taught that God was an angry old white guy in the sky that would drop you into a pool of everlasting fire for some very small infractions. And I'd committed all those infractions many, many, many times over. So I knew I was doomed. I was absolutely doomed. And I hated and feared this higher power. Didn't know that I hated it until I got sober a while in AA. And I'm almost embarrassed to tell you that I hung on to that old idea of God for 18 and a half years. And one day I just said, that's it, I'm dropping this. I don't have any need to carry this crap anymore. So I let go of the old concept, and that's all it was a concept of God, and just let go of it altogether. And it's the greatest relief I've ever had in my life of any kind. I don't have any contact or connection with that kind of a concept of a higher power anymore. I have a new higher power that kind of gradually evolved, and I just call it the healing power of Alcoholics Anonymous today. The healing power of Alcoholics Anonymous. That comes out of my own personal experience. I have seen hundreds of people come back from the dead, literally. We had a guy up in Santa Barbara who is now deceased of natural causes, but he had T-boned a semi-truck on his motorcycle doing about 70 miles an hour. Boom. He's out there in the highway dead, and they put him in a body bag and took him to the morgue. And one of the morgue attendants was looking at this body bag and said, this one is moving. So they pulled him out of the body bag and took him up to the ICU, and he recovered. He was just terribly drunk. He wasn't dead at all. Now, that's a lot farther through the gates of insanity and death than I want to go. But, you know, he was a character. He was an absolute, total character. This healing power of Alcoholics Anonymous that I claim for a higher power, I'm going to ask the blessing of that higher power on all of us today. Thanks.